When George was telling me these things, his eyes were round, startled again by the memory of his terror. I've been held up in the store lots of times by men with pistols and knives, and I've been plenty scared, but nothing like this, ever. He accents, and repeats, the last phrase. He kept his car moving slowly, but the figures paid no attention to him. Each one carried a large spoon-like tool and a little bag with a handle. They moved quickly. In George's words, they came down this ladder thing like kids coming down a fire escape. Fast. No wasted motion. They dug, spooning the dirt into their bags. In a few moments, they were back inside and the UFO ascended, moving north. George, at his closest, was 60 feet away. The entire incident took place in less than 4 minutes. I asked George what he did when he got home. Hey, I was sweating. I immediately made some tea. Usually he turned on the TV and watched a late movie, but he was too frightened to risk leaving any lights on in his apartment. I went to bed. I was that scared. I pulled the covers over my head. I got up and took 2 aspirin. You know, I was scared. I figured the whole damn world had come to an end. I didn't know what the hell to think. I thought either I'm going crazy or there's something awfully wrong down there. The next morning, George went back to the park. He walked over to the spot where the UFO had landed. There in a small area were about 15 little holes, 4 or 5 inches deep. He said, you know, when I went there and saw those holes, I got even more scared. I'll tell you something. I even felt those holes. I didn't believe it looking at them. I put my hand in one. Like most people who have had experiences like his, George tried every means he could to wish away the memory. He wanted to believe he had dreamed the whole thing, or even that I had somehow slipped a gear. He told me that when he saw and felt the holes, he had to go home and make some more tea and take 2 more aspirin. Though eventually we located a number of other people who also saw, in North Hudson Park and on the same night, what was undoubtedly the same UFO, the confirmation of his sighting has, if anything, made it more disturbing for him. A common misconception about people who report encounters with unidentified flying objects is that they believe in UFOs. The fact is that very few witnesses have a priori beliefs. They are firm about the accuracy of their descriptions of color, shape, height, movement, etc., but they offer few explanations of what they believe the object was. In a reflective moment, George has told me he has theorized that the government or the CIA or perhaps a foundation somewhere has developed a secret method of propulsion, powering totally unconventional craft like the one he saw. But then, he added, it makes no sense. Why couldn't they just send up for soil samples? And how could they recruit all the landing in North Hudson Park, those little guys? A normal run would have guys all heights. It doesn't make sense. As I listened to George's story, I noticed certain internal details which reinforced the conviction I held about his veracity. First of all, probably no one making up a story like this, and for what reason, would, in effect, leave himself out of the events. George's role is strictly passive. Never once does a small figure notice him, turn towards him, threaten him, or hand him a message. He merely drives by, watching. Almost all serious UFO reports involve benign, or at least neutral behavior, and George's story, in this respect, is typical. Second, it seems to me that anyone inventing a sensational encounter with space beings would begin by creating a weird, memorable face, huge eyes, pointed ears, or whatever, and then work down to trivial details. George's snow-suited kids wore helmets, obscuring their faces, yet he is sure that their boots were of one piece with their trouser legs. And far from giving himself a heroic role in the encounter, George underlined how petrified he had been. You just stop functioning, he said, and went on to admit that he, a man in his 70s, had gone to bed with the covers pulled up over his head. When the UFO took off, it flew north extremely quickly and lightly, he recalled, as if it were metal and somewhere high up there was a giant magnet attracting it. Listening to George's particular choice of imagery, I had the inescapable impression that an intelligent, careful man was trying his best to find words to describe an almost incredible experience. It was essential, I realized, to locate an investigator from a serious UFO organization who would know exactly what to do next. A few phone calls led me to Ted Blocher, at that time New York State Director of MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, and an investigator with 25 years' experience. On November 20th, Ted came to my studio to listen to the tape I had made in George's store. He was entranced, it is difficult not to be, by George's diamond, in their rough account. Everyone connected with UFO research has heard dreams of scientific and quasi-scientific speculation about these machines as yet unknown method of propulsion. George put it this way, when it took off, I looked underneath, you know. I said. There must be a big fan in there or something that runs this thing, but I can't see nothing. In subsequent months he returned to this theme. You know, when I was a kid I saw everything. I saw the dirigibles and they made noise. There, little biplanes used to come to the towns, and you'd have to pay a quarter to watch them land and take off, and they made more noise. And then they had the airlines with twin engines and they made a terrible racket. After the war, there were the jets and they practically deafened you. Each time they made something go faster, it was harder on the ears. Now they have the Concorde, and it's the fastest of all and nobody wants it around because when it middle dot takes off it shakes all the shingles off their houses. But this thing I saw that night in the park. It made only a little hum, just like a refrigerator starting up. And it went away almost before you could blink an eye. I'll tell you. I've never seen or heard anything like it. It was awesome. Ted Blocher introduced me to a young UFO investigator named Gerald Stuhrer, and on Saturday, November 23rd, we three drove to North Hudson Park to meet George and reenact his 3-after-midnight encounter. The plain where the UFO landed is a large athletic field, rimmed by trees and used for both football and softball. The UFO crew would have had a nice view of the Upper Manhattan skyline because the landing site is directly opposite West 88th Street. In fact, the ship Carney down less than 4 miles from there, North Hudson Park is a pleasant, manicured place, about a quarter of the size of Central Park. It has a lake, a wooded area, and the genteel, well-tended lawns common to civilized city parks. At the precise spot where George told us the ship touched down there is a thick mat of coarse grass, within which we found a series of 15 or so bare places, about 6 inches in diameter, where the grass was entirely missing. There are no actual holes remaining, but the dirt in each little grassless circle contained no traces of roots, a fact discovered by Ted Blocher when he took soil samples for possible future examination. Several weeks later we located the park custodian, whose job includes packing any holes he finds on the playing field to prevent accidents. He remembered that, in the early summer, he had refilled a number of small holes in the general vicinity. He had no idea what caused them, but assumed they must have been dug by unleashed dogs. On this sunny afternoon, Ted stationed himself at the precise landing spot while Stuhrer and I got into George's car. George took the wheel to retrace his route that January night. With the middle dot tape recorder going and Stuhrer timing each incident as George recalled it, we rode along through the park, listening to his story. From the moment his radio started to misbehave till the UFO lift off, slightly under 4 minutes elapsed. The drive established a plausible time frame, and we had a new, more detailed account to compare with the earlier one. At the bottom of the hill by the park is a tall, circular, modern structure named, ironically, the Stonehenge Apartments. By coincidence, I knew the building because a collector of my work once lived there, and I remembered that Stonehenge is served by 24-hour doormen. The building sits atop the Palisades, and tenants who face the Hudson River have a dramatic downstream view of Manhattan. The main entrance, however, is on the side which faces North Hudson Park. An alert doorman would have had an excellent view of anything coming to earth in the spot George had pointed out to us. I walked down the hill, 300 yards or so from the landing site to the front door, preparing to ask a few questions. The doorman on duty was a large, hearty, helpful man by the name of Eddie Opputabussing. I told him that I was investigating an incident that had occurred in the park the previous January, very late at night, that might involve a UFO. I deliberately withheld any other details such as precise date, location, description of the object, etc. Eddie told me that the two night men who worked at the Stonehenge that January had both since left for other jobs. However, one of them, Bill Pawlowski by name, had reported an odd incident, sometime in January, during the small hours. One of the huge plate glass windows at the entrance had been shattered under rather unclear circumstances. Eddie had not been in touch with Pawlowski for many months, but he was kind enough to find his new address for me. Ted Blocher is a walking encyclopedia of Air Force and civilian UFO reports. He felt, when I told him about the broken window, that there was probably no connection whatsoever between the accident and the UFO sighting, and it was only in subsequent months that he came across a case or two indicating something of a precedent. One, there was no such difficulty with landing and soil gathering reports such as George's. There are scores of similar accounts of small figures digging earth samples and even removing plants from farms. These events apparently have occurred over a span of some 30 years in the United States, France, South America, and elsewhere. And it is extremely common for witnesses to such preposterous events to hesitate, like George, for months before telling anyone their stories. Ridicule and disbelief are predictable responses. George Obarski, a widower, did not awaken his son to tell him what happened that night. Not until the next day, after he had returned to the park and examined the holes, did he finally unburden himself. George told me that, had he seen a policeman 5 minutes after the UFO had taken off, he would not have reported it. A man my age telling a story like this, why, they'd put you away. If you'd come in here a year ago and told me the same story, I wouldn't have believed you, either. The pressure to share his perplexity and fear must finally have been too strong, and in a very hesitant, guarded way he had approached me, though he had no reason to believe I would be a sympathetic listener. Bill Pawlowski, the former doorman, proved to be difficult to locate. I called him at his home in southeastern New Jersey many times over a two-week period. As I learned later, he was working nights at a security job and the phone was unplugged during the daytime so he could sleep. On December 5th, I reached him. I said that I was looking into an incident that had occurred in the park opposite the Stonehenge apartments the previous January and asked if he recalled seeing anything odd. His answer was immediate. He said that he did recall an incident, and that it had been frightening. It had been 2 or 3 in the morning and he had looked up into the park because he had suddenly noticed some extremely bright lights shining down the hill towards him. These lights, he said, were in a horizontal row, 10 to 15 of them, regularly spaced. He had never seen anything like it. For a moment, he wondered if it couldn't possibly be an evenly parked row of automobiles shining their headlights towards him, but then he realized the lights appeared to be about 10 feet off the ground. He could make out a continuous dark mass surrounding the row of illumination. He knew that he was seeing something disturbingly unusual. He walked over to the window for a better view, and then decided to call a tenant in the building. He turned behind him to the phone, dialed the number, and began to speak when he heard a high, pitched vibration and a sudden crack. The lobby window had broken at a low point near his feet. He hung up and crouched down to look at the break. When he glanced up a moment later, the lights were gone. He immediately called the police. They responded promptly, he said, probably because a North Bergen police lieutenant lives in the building. The two patrolmen and Pawlowski examined the break, which turned out to be peculiar. Whatever struck the glass did not come through. On the outside, There was an indentation as if a marble of glass had been gouged out of the surface. From this little crater radiated a series of cracks. No projectile could be found anywhere nearby. Opposite the front entrance to Stonehenge is a wide driveway bordered by a low wall, and behind the wall there is a 10-foot drop. Whatever broke the window had to have come from above, and it was clear to Pawlowski the shot was fired from the hill across the road. He did not, however, tell the police about the lights in the park. Again, the old reluctance to open oneself to ridicule. The lights had disappeared, he said, and I thought they'd never believe me anyway, so I didn't tell them. I just suggested they drive around up there and see what they could find. They resumed their patrol, but skipped the park altogether. It turns out that North Hudson Park does not fall within the jurisdiction of the North Bergen Police Department. I asked Pawlowski if he had told anyone else that night about the object in the park, and, to my immense relief, he had. Their police lieutenant who lived in Stonehenge, at Delghordio, was on night duty and returned at about 6:30 a.m., some 3.5 or 4 hours after the landing in the park. Bill was on friendly terms with the lieutenant and told him his story. On December 9th, I phoned Lieutenant Delghordio to ask him about it. He is a brusque, no-nonsense kind of professional, judging by his voice. My questions, specifically, were, did he know Bill Pawlowski, and what had the former doorman told him the night their window was broken? Sure, I knew him, said the lieutenant. He used to work nights. I came in about 6:30 that morning and he had some wild story about this big thing with lights on it that came down in the park. He thought it was involved with the broken window. But you can't believe a story like that. He must have been drinking or something. The all-purpose answer, like shut up. Each detail of Pawlowski's story confirmed Obarski's. George had seen the object from a moving car, so it was not easy for him to estimate the number of lighted windows visible from a single point of view. He guessed 10 or 12, and possibly as many as 15. Pawlowski remembered seeing 10 to 15 lights. He was nervous enough not to count. George had said that the UFO stopped 10 feet off the ground and then settled a bit until it was only about 4 feet from the field. Pawlowski's guess, from approximately 300 yards away, was that the lights were 10 feet off the ground. Since the lights did not extend all the way to the bottom of the UFO, their estimates are quite similar. Both agreed that the entire sighting had lasted only 3 minutes or so, and both set the time as around 3 a.m. All this information was elicited separately and voluntarily from each, and neither man had ever met or spoken to the other. I ended my phone conversation to Pawlowski thoroughly shaken. What had begun as an almost incredible story, which I believed, told to me by a man I had known then for 17 years, had just turned into something more complicated, more certain, and more disturbing. An unknown craft of some sort had landed 1 mile from Broadway, and 60 feet from poor George Obarski driving home from work. The uniformed, and uniform, crew had disembarked and taken Earth samples. Why, and why from this spot? Scenarios followed as I tried to put the parts together. Aboard the UFO, had someone, or something, seen, in the large round building down below, a uniformed human looking back up the hill? Bill Pawlowski in his Stonehenge livery unfortunately reached for the phone, and crack went the window. End of phone call. End of soil collection. Somehow the shot seemed more like a warning than a miss. The next step Ed, Jerry Sturer, and I planned was to interview Pawlowski in greater depth in hopes of bringing up additional information. And then, more crucially, to take him back to the park so that he could show us exactly where he saw the UFO. We gave him no details whatsoever from George's account. We wanted his memory to be as pure as possible. Under further questioning, Bill remembered something else which intrigued us. At the foot of the hill across from Stonehenge is a large tree made up of three trunks growing from one set of roots. One trunk grew somewhat parallel to the ground, but in a direct line with both the Stonehenge entrance and the UFO site atop the hill. Pawlowski insisted that, when the sun came up the morning of the landing, the large trunk was broken and hanging down. He believes the same weapon which cracked the window also sliced through the tree. The Park Service has since cut back the broken trunk, almost to the ground, so we will probably never know if the two accidents had the same mysterious cause. Central, now, to our investigation was the matter of exactly where Pawlowski remembered seeing the UFO. He returned to the park on December 11th, his first visit in months, with Jerry Stuhr, and, from his old post at the Stonehenge entrance, looked back up the hill. He had recalled a pole which apparently bisected the lights, as if it were in front of, but close to, the UFO. Atop the hill there had been a flagpole, since removed, but it had been located about 200 feet to the left of the place Obarski put the landing site. Pawlowski looked, pondered, and finally decided that it could not have been the flagpole in front of the lights, because he remembered them being further to the right, where, in fact, a tall lamppost stands. He walked straight up into the park to the exact spot that Obarski had named. Jerry had been holding his breath. He relaxed. We had our final detail confirmed. Bill never saw the diminutive crew members, which is not surprising. First of all, they were working on the ground about 50 feet or so back from the crest of the hill, so they probably would not have been visible from the entrance to the Stonehenge. Also, the difficulty in looking out from inside a lighted room, through the reflections on the glass, obscures small details. Bill was only able to see the unusually bright lights and the darkish shape containing them. He was amazed when we finally told him the other details of George's account. He seemed to be feeling a mixture of both envy and relief that Obarski had been about 1,000 feet closer to the UFO and its busy occupants. One of the areas one routinely checks in such cases is the FAA's air traffic control to see if a radar operator might have tracked an unidentified object that night. The New York, New Jersey area FAA spokesman I talked to had nothing for me on this case, but he was interested in the report for personal reasons. A number of years ago, he told me, when he was himself a traffic controller for an upstate New York airport, he tracked a UFO at supersonic speeds. Most interestingly, and this is quite uncommon UFO behavior, the object was in level flight, parallel to the ground. Controllers at the two airfields closest to his reported that they, too, were tracking the UFO on their radar screens. He explained to me that, in this recent North Hudson Park case, the UFO would probably not have been picked up. Now, a computer system intervenes between the actual radar scope and the screens that the controllers use. Most non-aircraft-like radar targets are automatically siphoned off the controllers' screens, thus avoiding ground clutter, inversions, and other potentially confusing data. When I explained the location and altitude and incredible speed of the UFO as George described it, he assured me that the computer would probably have automatically eliminated it, and no controller would have ever seen it on his screen. In the course of interviews we conducted with other Stonehenge staff members, we learned that Frank Gonzalez, the doorman who worked on Pawlowski's nights off, had once confided in a fellow employee about a sighting he had made. Gonzalez had left the Stonehenge months before for a job in Riverdale, where he lived with his wife and daughters. Ted called him at his new apartment and set up an appointment for Sunday, the 1st of February. We were eager to learn whatever we could about his sighting, which evidently preceded the Obarski-Pawlowski encounter. Francisco Frank Gonzalez is a small, neat, careful man whose English is far from fluent. His teen, aged daughter gracefully helped the three of us over the inevitable linguistic rough spots. Frank's sighting occurred between 2 and 3 a.m. on Monday morning, January 6, 6 days to the hour before the landing in the park witnessed by Obarski and Pawlowski. He had been standing inside the main entrance to the Stonehenge when he noticed a large, bright light hovering motionless above the playing field in North Hudson Park. Curious, he opened the door and stepped outside. I saw something round, very bright, you know, with some windows. I hear some noise. It's not like a helicopter, nothing like that. Like a plane, no, no. Something different. I was afraid, I tell you, I come back, inside. Then, you know, I see that light go straight up and I said, oh, God. Gonzalez guessed that the object was about as high up as the 20th floor of Stonehenge Apartments. He described the sound it made as a heavy sound, which almost hurt his ears, and the imitation he attempted came close to George's refrigerator motor drone. Another detail from the later encounter was confirmed when he described the color of the light. Obarski had been firm about the fact that the light from the windows was of a regular incandescent hue, that is, closer to amber than to the blue of fluorescent lamps. We asked Gonzalez about the hue of the lights he saw. Jello, he answered, and his daughter delicately removed the Cuban J and turned the word into its proper yellow. With marvelous ingenuousness, Frank produced a drawing for us of the craft he had seen. It had a bottom ringed with rectangular windows, but no top. I couldn't see the top of it, he admitted. It was dark, but the bottom was all bright. When he first sighted the UFO, he had called the security guard, but unfortunately for all of us, he was in the garage and unavailable as a confirming witness. We gave Frank a rough map showing some of the landmarks in the park, the flagpole, the various roads, the playing field, and he unhesitatingly placed the UFO directly over the field in exactly the spot where Pawlowski and Obarski had seen it touch down 6 days later. Furthermore, Frank described a kind of spotlight on the craft's underside illuminating what was to be its eventual landing site. The entire episode suggested a preliminary reconnaissance flight to check out the terrain in an almost old-fashioned military sense. Our speculation along these lines was strengthened when, about 2 months later, Jerry Stura located witnesses to yet another preliminary flight, by what has to be the same UFO, and this time only a few hours before the final landing. Early in January, before I had heard Frank Gonzalez's story, I began writing an account of the North Hudson Park landing. It was published in the Village Voice on March 1st, and caused something of a stir in the vicinity of the Stonehenge Apartments. One of the reasons I wrote the piece in the first place was that I hoped it might flush out a few more witnesses to an event I knew had to have been seen by more people than just George and Bill. To this purpose, I had deliberately refrained from including certain facts in my article. I did not specify the exact date, saying only that it was in mid-January. I did not describe the color of the body of the object itself. Very dark, said George, almost black. And there was a third crucial fact, the weather. January 1975, as one would expect, was mostly cold, with the temperature remaining in the 20s and 30s. Only twice did it rise into the 40s. But at 3 a.m. on the 12th, when the UFO landed, it was in the high 50s, and at 9:30 p.m. on the 11th, about 5 hours before the landing, it was a balmy 63 degrees. It was important for us to keep these pieces of information undisclosed, to provide a test of the veracity of anyone who subsequently might come forward claiming to have seen the UFO. Towards the end of March, Jerry Stura gave a talk to a PTA group in North Bergen on the subject of UFOs. After he finished, 12-year-old Robert Wamsley and his mother, Alice, approached him to tell of their sighting. At 9:30 on a Saturday night, they were sure of the time because the family had been watching the Bob Newhart show on television. Robert glanced out the window and saw, to his complete amazement, a round, domed craft, brilliantly lit, just outside the house. The Wamsleys live 12 blocks south of North Hudson Park, or about 14 blocks from the Stonehenge Apartments. Robert alerted his mother and the rest of the family. Joseph Wamsley, the father, and the other children, Joseph, Jr., age 16, and Debbie, 13, ran outside for a better look. The UFO was encircled by rectangular windows, which gave off a yellowish light. It was moving very slowly, perhaps 40 or 50 feet off the ground, and it glided at a slight angle, as if, Mrs. Walmsley thought, it was looking in people's windows. Stuha visited the Walmsleys 2 days later and collected further details. The UFO had flown along Boulevard East toward North Hudson Park.